secretary, although they could drag her into the sitting-room should they choose to demonstrate the degree of police brutality she no doubt expected from the likes of them. She put her weight on one hip and her hand on the other. The stance said, "What?" better than she could have done. "We've more than one person who's seen you with PCSO Ruddock," Lindley began. She cut in at once with, "You've got more in one person line, then." "We're not here to ask you for particulars," Lindley said.
"Between you and me,"
Havers put in, "we'd rather not know 'em. Top, bottom, whatever, your secrets are safe."
"I'm never wrong."
"You did." The girl looked close to tears, which seemed at odds with her defiance. There was something more going on here, Lindley thought. He said, "Ding, you're not in trouble. But we have several people so far who've seen you with PCSO Ruddock, and Sergeant Havers here is one of them. What we want to know is whether you were with him in the patrol car on the night that the deacon, Ian Druitt, died at the police station. Whatever your relationship is with Gary Ruddock isn't our concern, but..." Ding burst into tears. She covered her face with her hands. Within moments she was weeping as if no power on earth could contain her grief. Havers murmured, "Bloody hell," as Lindley went to the girl.
"What's happened, Ding?"
he said to her quietly. "You must see that it's time to tell us." Havers decamped at once to the kitchen. The water ran. The kettle was filled. It was the English answer to everything, Lindley thought. Ding began to slide down the wall, but Lindley caught her. As her weeping turned to sobbing, he gently removed the rucksack from her back and put his arm around her shoulder. "You're quite fine," he said. "Is anyone else here?" And when she shook her head wordlessly, he said, "Were you with him?"
"No!"
she wailed the word. He led her in the direction of the kitchen, saying, "Ding, it's down to you to help us understand."
"Yes, but no!"
she cried.
"No!"
Havers had a chair out from the table. She'd found tea mugs and tea from their earlier visit, and she had them ready. She seemed to understand where Lindley did not. She said,
"You mean yes, you've been with him, but no, not on the night that the deacon died?"
The girl nodded. Havers handed her a kitchen towel at the same moment as Lindley was bringing out one of his pristine handkerchiefs. Ding took the kitchen towel and crushed it against her face.
"I don't want,"
she said, and then she drew in a breath and went on with,
"He knows. I don't want to go home."
"He told us you don't want to go home to your parents," Lindley said. "He said it's to do with your drinking, that you don't want your parents to know about it. He's picked you up more than once amongst the bingers. Is that not the truth?" She wasn't pretty when she wept. Hardly anyone was. Her skin became blotchy, her nose turned red, and her lips moved spasmodically. She managed to say,
"It's more than that. The rest of them don't care what he says, and they don't need to, but I do, and it's why it happens. It started with the binging, and I said okay, because if my mum knew how bad it was, she would make me live at home, not here, and I couldn't, only I didn't know why, only now I do. He figured that, the first part, that I couldn't, so he said we can have a deal, you and me, and here's what it will take, at the police station in the car park, and I said I would do whatever, because you don't know how much I didn't want to be at home, so I did whatever, and then he would take me home, not to my parents, but here to Teamside."
The water had boiled. Havers brought mugs to the table. Lindley was sorting through Ding's declarations, one at a time, but the sergeant made a leap that perhaps only a woman could make, considering what they'd heard. She said,
"You performed sex favours for him when he caught you binging. If you hadn't done, he would have carted you home to your parents drunk."
She nodded, weeping anew. "And the other girls?" Lindley asked.
"Some. I don't know. Not Francie, see, because she wouldn't care pins what her parents said, because she lives at home anyway, and they don't. Well, they travel lots, and she does what she wants, and they let her, and they know they can't, I don't know, tie her up or something."
Lindley nodded. The girl had eye makeup down her cheeks, and she'd even got some on her forehead as well, and he had a sudden urge to clean off her skin, a desire that he knew had more to do with protection than anything else. He said, "But you've kept binging?" She shook her head.
"Hardly ever, but it stopped mattering. To him, I mean. It ended up not having to do with binging at all. He picks me up when he's decided I've been binging. Sometimes I'm walking back to Teamside from the library, and there he is, and I don't want to go home, and he knows it. I was afraid all the time when it started, because it was like I'd finally escaped, only I didn't know what I'd escaped from anyway. And I thought, what's it really matter when I'm doing these other blokes, and I can't live there, I can't!
Can you be certain you weren't with him the night Ian Druitt died? Linley asked. For if her claims about Ruddock were true, how could the girl actually know when she'd been with him and when she'd not, unless she'd kept some sort of record? Linley gave her the exact date.
"I wasn't," she said. "If someone was, it wasn't me."
"How can you be so sure?" Havers asked.
"That's my mum's birthday," she said. "I was at home, in Much Wenlock. You can ask Francie or Chelsea, because that was before Francie. We were friends then. They went home with me."
Ironbridge, Shropshire. Yasmina didn't bother with a shopping trolley because she didn't need one. Inside the market, she picked up a basket instead. There would be three of them having dinner, but she couldn't face preparing an actual meal, so she planned to search for ready-made items that she could remove from containers and present to Tim and to Sati as if she'd made them herself. She looked at what was on offer. The difficulty was that she wasn't hungry, and that for her eating was now something she was doing for medicinal purposes only. Other than that, it was to set an example for Sati. "See, Mummy is eating, and you must also do so, darling." Quiche, she thought. Perhaps lasagna. Haddock and peas. Place and chips. It was just so difficult when one didn't feel hunger.
"It's Dr. Lomax, isn't it?"
Yasmina looked up. An attractive woman with cornflower eyes and a tartan jacket over slim trousers was smiling tentatively at her. Yasmina frowned as she failed to place her.
"It's Selina Osborne," she said. "Misa was my pupil in fourth form."
"Oh, my goodness, yes, of course,"
Yasmina said, although the truth was she couldn't remember the woman's face at all.
"I didn't recognize you at first." "It's my hair," she said. "New colour, new style. How are you? I imagine you're quite pleased and excited about Missa and Justin."
Yasmina couldn't track this. Excited would be the last descriptive term she'd use when it came to her frame of mind.
"I'm not quite certain."
Selina gave a light laugh.
"Oh, sorry. I saw the announcement in the registry office when Toby and I went to post our own engagement."
She showed her ring, blushing as she did so.
"It's second time round for us both, so I really didn't want a ring, but he insisted. We're planning on just the registry office, but I expect you've got something else in mind for me, sir, and Justin, haven't you? I remember them both so well. Especially Justin, with that lovely face of his, always so serious, and all that hair falling into his eyes. One could tell from the first that it was only me, sir, he would ever care for. And now here they are, posting the banns for their marriage."
She laughed again and placed her hand on her chest, adding,
"I can't tell you how old that makes me feel."
Yasmina nodded. She said faintly,
"Oh, yes, I expect it does. Do give them my best, won't you? Tell her Mrs. Osborne, soon to be Mrs. Joyce, sends her very good wishes."
"I will indeed,"
Yasmina said. When Selina Osborne walked off, happily pushing her trolley, Yasmina turned to the foodstuffs and blindly picked up packages, not caring what they were. She wanted to believe there was some mistake. She couldn't accept that things had come to this, when all along she had recognized the likelihood of things coming exactly to this. Timothy had predicted it. Rabia had tried in her way to warn against it, but Yasmina had not wanted to hear. And there was nothing for it but to turn to the one person who truly might be able to see the ludicrousness of an early marriage between Justin and Missa. The one person who surely would have a concern equal to her own. So she carried her selections to the till, and after she'd made the purchase, she drove to the Museum of the Gorge. The museum stood on the bank of the River Severn. It was a former foundry whose original architect had disguised the massive building's use by including in its brick construction a series of gables, a crenellated roofline at the east and west ends, and smokestacks disguised with additional crenellation to suggest a castle rather than an ironworks. Additionally, facing in the direction of Ironbridge proper, a large bay with perpendicular diamond-paned windows gave the building a church-like appearance, as if the architect hadn't quite been able to decide what would work best to assure the townspeople that neither the air they breathed nor the water they drank was of questionable nature as a result of having a foundry in their immediate vicinity. The railway tracks, leading directly into the building, defeated its disguise, however, as did its position just above the river and near enough to it to have been flooded so many times that its continued existence was something of a miracle. It was minutes from the closing hour, and there were only three vehicles in the car park. Yasmina went inside and asked the ticket seller for Linda Goodale, since Justin's mum, as Yasmina well knew, was the director of the museum. She also knew that it was a source of pride to the Goodale clan that Linda had begun as a ticket seller years earlier, when the museum was a mere shadow of the impressive educational facility it was today. She'd risen through the ranks exactly as her husband had done at Blist's Hill Victorian town. Despite their lack of university degrees, or even any form of college, they were doers, movers and shakers, the Goodales. After a moment on the phone, the ticket seller told her that the museum's director was finishing a few things up, and would be with her presently. She could have a look round if she wished. There was a new diorama that might be of interest. Yasmina said that she would wait outside, enjoying the afternoon sun. The ticket seller gave an indifferent shrug and went back to whatever she'd been doing on her computer. Outside, Yasmina walked to the wall at the edge of the car park. The river was at a healthy level, she saw, its lower banks knotted with bluebells that tangled with golden saxifrage. As the bank climbed upwards, wild grasses grew thickly, among which wolfsbane raised its hooded heads. Opposite where she stood, willows and alders offered their fresh spring leaves to the sunlight. May had always been her favourite month of the year, but this particular May was one she wished she had experienced in a coma.
"Dr. Lomax," Yasmina turned. She recognised Linda Goodale, of course, as they'd known each other for years. She also recognised what it meant that Linda had not used her given name. She said, "Please, Yasmina, may I speak with you, Linda? It's urgent."
Linda observed her with an expression that seemed devoid of all sentiment. She said,
"Yeah, I expect it is. Your lot don't much like surprises."
Yasmina wasn't fool enough to think there was nothing behind Linda's choice of distinct accent. She was using it as an implication from which Yasmina was meant to infer, "Our backgrounds are different, and don't I know how you feel about mine?" Yasmina felt her teeth dig into her lips. This wasn't how they were meant to begin. Somehow Linda Goodale had quickly managed to get the upper hand.
"But there's always surprises in life, innit?"
Linda dug round in her bag and brought out a pack of chewing gum. It was, Yasmina saw, a nicotine gum of the sort people used when they were trying to give up smoking. She realised that she hadn't known Linda smoked in the first place, and she wondered if this lack of knowledge on her part marked her as a social snob.
"So this speaking you want to do, Yasmina, it's about my Justin, innit?"
Linda popped a piece of the gum into her mouth and shoved its wrapper into the pocket of the hip-length cardigan she was wearing.
"What I mean, of course, is my Justin and your missus. That's why you've stopped to have a little word with me."
"Please, oh, please stop speaking like that," was what Yasmina wanted to say, because of the disadvantage Linda was causing her, but she knew that going in that direction would result in a conversation about class and any social differences that existed between their respective children, and to whatever Linda believed that Yasmina thought about those differences. But the matter between them had nothing to do with class, although the Goodales would probably never think that was the case.
"You must know they've registered to marry," Yasmina said. "The banns are posted."
Linda's face hardened at this direct approach.
"Not living under a rock like some people, happens I do know," she said. "Got to say that I did wonder how long it would take you to get the information, as I don't see you running to the registry office every day to keep tabs on the goings-on round here. But you managed it quick enough."
"One of their former teachers told me just now. She wanted to congratulate me."
"I bet that one surprised you, eh? You must have thought condolences were more the order of things."
"Linda, please. I know it's what they want. I know it's... it seems to me it's what everyone wants."
Linda opened her mouth to answer this, but Yasmina went quickly on, saying,
"And I'm not opposed to it."
"That's not what I've heard."
"It's only that I don't wish them to marry so young. When people are too young and they marry..."
"You must think I'm thick."
Linda popped her gum loudly. That had to be deliberate, like her accent, like her choice of words. When she went on, however, she had utterly dropped the working-class game she was playing. She said,
"I expect you think dimness runs in our family. This bit, whatever it is that you claim to feel or believe, it has nothing to do with their ages. It would be the same for you if Justin was 28 and Missa was 26. It's really to do with what you think of Justin."
"That's not true. He's a wonderful boy. He's always been important to our family and to Missa. My objections..."
"That's what this is, isn't it? Your objections. We're down to it now. Here comes the list."
"I've never denied wanting Missa to attend university," Yasmina said. "She has a very good brain, which Justin does not, according to you, and I would be remiss if I didn't encourage her to use it, just as you would have been remiss not to encourage Justin as you did. He told me about that when he showed me what he's been doing with building those little houses of his."
"Pods,"
Linda said sharply. "He's building something called Pods. Quite successful he is at it, by the way, which isn't a surprise to me, as I always believed his strength was in using his hands."
"Yes, I so agree, just as Missa's strength is her brain.
But this is where you and I part ways."
"How? Why?"
"You can't think that Missa..." "What I think," Linda said, "is that children are meant to discover their own strengths. They aren't meant to have their strengths thrust on them because their parents have some sort of plan in mind. You call your intentions for Missa's life your dreams for her, don't you? But they've never been that, what you've got in mind. They've been your plans. Whatever's on the path that you've decided is the one she'll take. And I bet you decided on that the day she was born."
"That isn't true. Missa herself fully intended to go to uni. She fully intended a future in science. She wanted these things, and then she didn't want them. She's thrown away her future, and she won't tell me why."
Linda looked away from her, as if she wanted "thrown away her future" to echo round the car park for a bit. She had put her attention on a garishly painted purple building across the street from the museum, where a woman sold crystals, various rocks from round the world, and badly made silver jewellery. She was just closing shop for the day, a process that involved removing candles and folding up a gold lamé cloth that covered a small table outside the front door. Yasmina added,
"And now she's told Sati that when she and Justin marry, Sati may live with them in their house. You must see that can't be allowed to happen."
Linda turned back to her. She walked to the wall and spat out the gum. She said, "Would this be the house you told Justin you would purchase for them if he could talk Missa into returning to college and then going on to uni? Is that the house, Yasmina? And course he believed you, didn't he? As he would do, not because he's dim like you think, but because he's honest. He appears to people exactly who he is, and he reckons other people are just the same. Only he's wrong, isn't he? Especially when it comes to you, his future mother-in-law. Linda, please, you can't want them to do this. My kids' lives aren't about what I want. My kids' lives are about making their own decisions and getting the consequences and coping with those. You think my Justin isn't good enough for me, sir? I'm not saying that. I've never said that. And it could be you're right as rain. And maybe that's what my Justin's meant to learn, that he's not the bloke for someone like Missa, no matter how he feels about her. But there's this as well. It could be Missa's not good enough for him. It could be that, at heart, she's just like her mum, not able to believe in Justin's talent and in his goodness. Perhaps, like you, she really thinks, underneath it all, that stringing together a mass of uni degrees is more important than being who you are every single day. I don't know. Neither do you. But what I suppose is this, Yasmina, we'll all find out eventually." She nodded sharply. She walked away in the direction of her car, an ages-old Audi and a special parking bay marked Director. Yasmina was left with nothing to say and was about to go to her own vehicle when Linda turned back to her.
"So I won't intercede for you," she said. "That's what you come to ask me to do, isn't it? All else has failed, and now it's down to Justin's parents. Stop this madness. Return Missa to her mother, where she belongs. I won't do that. I wouldn't have done it to one of my own children, and I certainly won't do it to one of yours."
Yasmina remained where she was, as Linda reversed the Audi and then left the car park. She felt a numbness that kept her rooted to the spot. It was impossible for her to believe that any mother would allow events to unfold in the life of her child as events were unfolding in Linda's own son's life. The future was rolling out in front of all of them with the speed of a bullet train, and no one wanted to lift a finger to alter its course. When she finally left the car park and drove along the River Severn, she saw nothing of it. The hillside that rose to her left and contained the homes of the town might not have been there at all, and the great brick factories that had once produced the iron for the goods sent all over England might have disintegrated into nothing. All she saw was the future, and what it could have been, and what it would be now. Sati, she decided, was her only hope. When she arrived home, she saw that Timothy was already there. She hoped that nothing played upon her face. He would not approve of her speaking to Linda Goodale, any more than he'd approved of a single thing she'd done to help Missa through this difficult time. She gathered up her groceries and her shoulder bag. She forced her expression to pleasant and went inside the house, finding at once that her concerns about Timothy's reading her were unfounded. While Sati was at the kitchen table dutifully struggling with her maths prep, Timothy was not with her. Having a lie-down was the information Sati passed along in a subdued voice. He said he was done in from the day. He said to tell Mummy that he wouldn't want dinner. He said sorry, but he needed rest. Yasmina knew what rest equated to.
She felt the urge to run upstairs, but how much, she asked herself, was one woman expected to cope with, and wasn't there a moment when that woman had to take life's hurdles one at a time, and in order of importance?
"Well, you and I shall have our dinner together, then."
Yasmina put her carrier bag on the worktop and smiled at her daughter. She said,
"What a good girl you are, Sati. Is your prep going well?"
Sati shook her head. Slowly she sucked her lower lip into her mouth, pulling it so tight that she disfigured her chin. It was a most unattractive habit that she needed to shed. Yasmina didn't mention it, however. Instead, she went to the table, stood at her daughter's shoulder, and gazed at her schoolwork.
"Oh, dear,"
she said as she took in the mess of it, rubbings, scratchings, and an area that looked as if it had been wept upon.
"It really shouldn't be this difficult. You have such an excellent mind. You merely have to be taught how to use it." "I don't understand it," Sati said. "I never will. I won't ever need it either, so I don't know why, but of course you'll need it, Sati. It's the basis of so many things. Science, technology, business. Not poetry, not writing, not art. But even then... Well, of course you don't want writing to be what you'll do with your professional life. I suppose if you teach... But why would you want to teach with a fine mind like yours? We'll find you a tutor."
Sati gazed at her wordlessly. She was 12 years old, but her eyes looked ancient. Yasmina emptied her carrier bag to see what she'd grabbed in the supermarket. Chili con carne, swede with cheddar, corned beef crisp bakes, spaghetti carbonara. She announced with a laugh that it would be dinner surprises all the way round, which she knew Sati would like especially.
"Misa can help me,"
Sati murmured, her gaze on the papers in front of her.
"She says she will."
"Of course," Yasmina said,
"but when she's back in college, it'll be difficult for her. But as I said, not to worry, there'll be a tutor, and while we look for one, there will be Gran to help you. We'll set about the tutor tomorrow, shall we? I saw Mrs. Osborne in the market only just now. Do you remember her? I'll ring her, and she'll know someone. Why don't you finish up there and help me with our dinner? Afterwards, we'll watch telly, shall we?"
Sati nodded. She closed her books and gathered them up. She took them to her bedroom, always the child who did as she was told to do. Yasmina had the table set and was reading the instructions on the containers of the bizarre meal she'd bought when Sati returned. Yasmina chatted to her about what a silly dinner they were going to have. She gaily talked about how she simply didn't know what she'd been thinking as she picked up this and that, her mind obviously flitting about on other things. A celebrity marriage, a celebrity divorce, reading over lunch about a silly American woman on a trip into the Rocky Mountains who had thought her anti-bear spray was intended to be sprayed upon her children to keep the bears away. But it was meant to be used if a bear came near, to be sprayed at the bear. Her children ended up in casualty, Sati. Can you imagine the condition they must have been in? Sati appeared to be engaged by the story. How mad it was to think someone would assume anti-bear spray was like mosquito spray. On the other hand, it did rather make sense, didn't it, Mum? Well, yes, but only if the spray had said on its label, "Bear Repellent, darling," which, naturally, was rather different. What did Sati wish to watch on the telly, by the way? Did she want to look at Radio Times to see what was on? She could choose. They would curl up together and perhaps have a chocolate ice each. That would be lovely, wouldn't it? When the meal was heated, Yasmina placed everything on the table, going to the effort of removing items from their containers and scooping them into serving dishes. She patted Sati's chair and spooned chili into her bowl. Onto her plate went some swede, some spaghetti carbonara.
"I'm not really hungry, Mum,"
Sati said, standing behind her chair and looking down at the food.
"Of course you are," Yasmina said. "We both must eat. Sit, sit, my darling, and afterwards, Mum. No, no, sit, sit, just eat a little. Do that for me, won't you, Sati?"
Sati sighed. She pulled the chair out and dropped onto it. She picked up a spoon, and when she toyed with her chili and ultimately put a teaspoonful of it into her mouth, Yasmina did not scold her or urge her to have more. She picked up her own spoon and dug into the bowl and tried to ignore the unpleasant mixture of scents from the different foods on the table. She chatted to her daughter. This, that, the other. Reality television, a royal faux pas, an increase in bullying, a decrease in bullying, whatever came into her mind. And then, finally, she ventured where she knew she had to go. She said,
"Sati, darling, I must tell you something that I learned today from Mrs. Osborne."
Yasmina waited for a sign of interest. When it did not come, she ventured on anyway.
"This was in the supermarket when I saw her, as I've said. I'm going to tell you what I learned from her, and then I must ask a favour of you."
Sati looked at her with those ancient eyes. She was such a pretty girl, Yasmina thought. Every handsome feature that her parents possessed had managed to blend together in her. It was as if Misa and Jana had been experiments in blending this and that, while Sati was the finished product, perfected after the first two tries. At 12 she was a child to be admired. At 20 she would cause people to stop and stare. Women would envy, men would desire. And Yasmina's job with this, her youngest child, was to make certain Sati understood how fleeting it was. Beauty was temporal. Wisdom was not.
"What?" Sati asked. "What favour, Mum?" "Let me tell you first what I learned from Mrs. Osborne."
Yasmina then revealed what she had been told, the registry office and the intended marriage of Missa to Justin Goodale.
"Mrs. Osborne was there with her fiancé to register their marriage, you see, and the banns were posted, Missa and Justin, to be married. Do you understand?"
As Yasmina had been speaking, Sati had dropped her gaze to her bowl of chili. She'd lifted a fork and moved the swede with cheddar here and there on her plate, but now she lifted her head, looked directly at Yasmina, and said quite unexpectedly,
"I'm not stupid, Mum."
Yasmina gave a laugh. It was too obviously forced, but she couldn't help that. There was something different in Sati's tone. She'd insulted her daughter without meaning to do so.
"I'm sorry, darling Sati," she said. "I didn't intend that. I suppose what I meant is that registering as they've done means it's to happen soon. It's perfectly legal, of course, they're both of age, but I think we ought to consider that this might not be the best for either of them."
She paused to gather her thoughts and to consider the best direction to take. She went with,
"Sati, here's what it is. A marriage when one is so young is nearly always doomed to fail, and I can't bear Missa going through such a thing as a failed marriage. Can you? I am convinced that Missa will listen to an appeal from you. She knows you miss her. She knows you need her. I want you to speak with her, do you understand? I would like you to meet with her at the Goodales' home, or to see her at Blist's Hill. I'm happy to drive you there, and when you do, I want you to ask her to come home. Tell her the truth. Mum is sorry for the mess she made of West Mercia College, and Mum apologizes with all her heart, and you, Sati, need her to be with you, which she will not be if she marries." "She told me I can come to live with them," Sati said abruptly.
Yasmina took up her glass and drank some water.
"Darling, surely if they do take the cottage in Jackfield—" "This was before all that, Mum. She told me that when she and Justin are married, I can live with them if I want to. They won't be living in a little cottage. They'll find a bigger one. She said there will be a room for me, not the spare room, but my own bedroom, and I can live with them."
Yasmina found that her mouth was dry. So were her lips. Even her palms felt completely desiccated. She said,
"Sati, darling girl, you aren't of an age to live anywhere but with your Mum and Dad. She said she'll tell me exactly when the wedding's going to be so I can go to it, and after that she and Justin will come for me, and I'll live with them."
It dawned on Yasmina that she'd missed a quite salient point as her daughter was speaking. She said,
"You already knew they'd registered to marry? She told me they were going to. They both told me. They asked did I want to come with them to the registry office, but I said no, as you would be angry if I did that, and they said it was quite all right if you were angry, and if I was frightened of you, Justin would come for me. I said I wasn't frightened, but I didn't want to upset you more, so I would wait. But then when they have everything ready, I would live with them."
Yasmina sank against the back of her chair.
"Why did you not tell me any of this? I knew you'd say no. I don't mean about living with them. I assure you that is not going to happen. I mean the registry office, the marriage, their intention."
Yasmina reached for Sati's arm. Her fingers closed over it in a grip that made the girl cry out.
"This is her future," Yasmina hissed. "Do you not understand that? This isn't a game. This isn't a way to slap Mum in the face. This is her life, you stupid girl. And you knew. You knew all along."
Sati pulled away.
"You're hurting me, Mum." "Nothing like I shall be hurting you later. What's the matter with you? Where is your sense? I could have been there waiting. I could have stopped it. I could have—" "That's what she said."
Sati's eyes filled.
"She said you would do anything. She said you hate her. She said you hate Justin. She said you hate anyone who doesn't do what you want them to do." "I do not. You're hurting me. Your nails—" "Stop it, Mum. Stop it."
She began to cry.
"I won't stay here. I won't stay with you. Janet is gone and Missa is gone. I have no one because I'm not anything, and I'm going to live with Missa and Justin, and you can't stop me, because if you try, and if you do, I'll run away, and you'll never find me, and I'll go to London, and I'll live on the street, and—"
Yasmina hit her so hard that Sati's head flew back. It took a moment before she realized that she'd not slapped her as she'd intended, but rather she'd punched her. She said,
"Oh, Sati! My God, Sati, my dear daughter!"
But in speaking, she'd also released her grip on the girl. Sati jumped to her feet. She ran for the door. Yasmina called after her with a desperation born of regret and sorrow and utter knowledge. The slamming door told her the damage was done. St. Julian's Well, Ludlow, Shropshire. When the doorbell sounded, Rabia Lomax's first thought was that the police had returned for more questioning of her. If the telly was anything to go by, they knew that the unexpected call at an off-duty hour, especially after 10 o'clock at night, was certain to produce better results than they'd managed to amass on an earlier go. When she opened her door, however, she came face to face with her younger son. The fact that he had a carrier bag, into which he'd apparently thrown a few garments, did not bode well, nor did his expression, which was so cut up that Rabia knew immediately that something terrible had occurred. She stepped back from the door. Timothy entered. He said nothing at first, merely going into the sitting room, dropping onto the sofa and letting the carrier bag fall from his fingers. "Sati is well," were his initial words, which drove a stake of fear straight through Rabia's midsection. She sat upon the closest piece of furniture at hand, which was an ottoman. Timothy rubbed his hand over his face, and from where Rabia sat, she could hear the scritch of his palm against whiskers. When he looked at her, she could see that his eyes were bloodshot, so she experienced another stake of fear that he'd been drinking. But he'd managed to drive all the way from Ironbridge, she realized, and he wasn't acting the least bit drunk. There were the pills as well, but he also wasn't acting drugged. "She's driven Sati off as well," he said. "I went after her once I came downstairs. I'd just gone to have a lie down, nothing more, and she probably thought I'd taken something that would keep me dead to the world. I hadn't. So I heard their voices, and then the door slamming. Hard this was. The door, I mean. The windows in the bedroom actually shook. Why does that happen? A house is not built well any longer." "What's going on, Tim?" Rabia asked. "You're frightening me. Could I have a glass of water, Mum? Tap water's fine, but if you have fizzy..." "Oh, fuck me. Why am I even thinking of what I prefer?" "Because you're a user," was what she could have told him, and that's fairly close to the number one indication. Me, 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 more me. But she said, "Of course," and she fetched him what she had, which was an open bottle of Pellegrino. He drank from that. She said, "What happened?" "Misa left us yesterday morning. Sati left us round dinner time today." "What do you mean, left?" "I reckon she'd gone to a mate's house at first, so that's where I started. I ended up at Justin's, which of course made sense, since Missa's there. For now this is, according to what I've been able to sort out. Just till after the wedding, when Sati intends to live with them. Missa and Justin, this is." He spoke dully, and when he was finished, Rabia could see why his eyes were bloodshot, as they filled with tears. She wanted to feel whatever pain he was going through in order to take it from him, only she found unexpectedly that she herself was feeling no pain at all. Rather, what she felt was fury. Not only at him, but at the whole boiling lot of them. "I can't cope with her any longer," he said. "I managed through Jana, but I can't. It's like she's started to believe... Only it's not, is it? It's not that she's started to believe anything. It's that she always believed, and I didn't want to see it. I tried to talk to her at first. I tried to tell her that everything she did would make life go wrong. But she would never see that. It was her duty, she would say. Just like her parents said to her, mould, shape, chisel, pound, whatever it takes to fit them into the hole you've prepared for them. You would think her own experience would have been enough to tell her that she got being a mother the wrong way round, but it turned out that her own experience made her that much more determined that the girls would profit by her mistakes. That's how she sees it. A mistake. Herself, me, how we got together, all of it. Fine and all right, then. I've tried, I'm finished." Rabia knew that the only possible way she was going to be able to stop herself from flying off the ottoman and shaking Timothy by his shoulders till his teeth rattled was to make him tell the story from start to finish, although she had worked out much of it during his rambling. She said, "I'm trying to follow what's happened. Yasmina's done something. It's ended up with the lot of you leaving." That was enough to get him talking. Yasmina's plan for Justin to cajole Misa about college and uni, Missa's very quick discovery of the plan, Missa's leaving, the two of them deciding then, or really perhaps they'd already done it, but who knew at this point, to post bans for their marriage. Yasmina's discovery of this, her conversation with Linda Goodale, the outcome of that conversation, and Yasmina's next manoeuvre to involve Sati in the whole miserable mess.
"She was in a state when I went downstairs," Tim said. "Misa getting married quickly and her father doing nothing to stop it so that she, Yasmina, would find herself in a position of having to beg Linda Goodale to help, and then that didn't work, because, for God's sake, why should it? She was on to Sati. What else was there left to do but blame me? Jana's death, Misa's decisions about her life, Sati running off because her mother punched her in the face.
Punched?
That's what she told me. But she was hysterical by then.
Sati? You were able to talk to her?
Yasmina, not Sati. And then it was go out there and find her, damn you, instead of drugging yourself like a useless addict under a bridge. Go, go! And I did, Mum. God, how I did. I grabbed some clothes and my shaving kit and I went, just like she wanted.
Are you saying that you didn't look for Sati? You've already told me that.
I did. Like I said, I meant to bring her here with me. But she wouldn't leave Misa, and Misa wouldn't leave Justin, and Justin wasn't about to agree to anyone going anywhere once he had a look at Sati's face. Do you know what it looks like when a 12-year-old girl is punched in the face, Mum?
He raised his gaze to take in the ceiling. Then he dropped it to her again.
God, I'm so sick and tired of not being able to do anything to protect them from her.
That, Rabia decided, was that. She rose so quickly she was like a runner who'd just heard the pistol.
That, she said, is the bloody goddamn limit to what's gone on in this family.
He clasped his hands together as if in prayer and said,
Oh, Mum, thank God you see, because there's no possible way. I am not talking about Yasmina, she snapped.
She approached the sofa and stood above him.
I'm not talking about Misa or Sati or our poor Jana. I'm talking about you. What in the name of God is wrong with you? Oh, never mind. Never mind. It's exactly what's wrong with your brother. And it killed your grandfather, so why the hell not you, eh? From the moment you reckon just one little time without protection, and how could she possibly come up pregnant in only one time, and anyway I'll pull out, won't I? That's what I'll do. From that very moment of gross stupidity, you've taken the easiest route every single time, and I've gone along and been there to help make things easier, and neither of us is doing that now. Do you hear me? Do you begin to understand me? You may have reached your limit with Yasmina, but I have reached my limit with you. You're no more moving in with me, Timothy, and do not dare tell me that's not the master plan here, then you're moving to Tahiti. You're growing up, and you're doing it directly, because I have no intention of taking the responsibilities of your life and putting them on my shoulders. If Yasmina went wrong with the girls, and I'm not saying she didn't, then where the dickens did you go right? She's had to bring those girls up by herself. This doesn't make what she's done sensible or even excusable, but it does make what she's done reasonable, given the hand she dealt herself when she was foolish enough to take up with you.
That she'd astonished him was beyond doubt. But as far as she was concerned, he stood 6 inches from the edge of a precipice, and a fall was going to mean he'd failed in the very same way his brother had done, losing everything for the simple reason that he could not man up. God, she was thinking like a telepsychologist at this bloody point, and take charge of himself. Easier just to talk oneself into believing that one was owed. The drink, the drug, the food, the sex, the bloody sodding whatever. If one didn't do that, one might actually have to do something else. And by God, that would take effort, wouldn't it? Because life took effort, and it was time he learned that.
"Stop gawping at me," she snapped. "Close your mouth, sit up straight, and stop blaming anyone but yourself. You may stay with me one night, Timothy, and only because it's late. Tomorrow morning you will deal with this like a husband and a father and a man, and just in case you're thinking you won't do that because what's the point, and you've tried and tried, and you haven't been able to get through to Yasmina and boo-hoo-hoo, I shall be with you. Not to take your part, by the way, but to make certain there is a part in the first place. Now get into the spare room, and I do not wish to see your face till morning."
For a moment she thought she might have gone too far with him. But then he said the most unexpected,
"Thank you, Mum,"
after which he took himself to the spare room with his carrier bag of clothing, and he closed the door.
23rd May. Ludlow, Shropshire. In Linley's experience, dirty in one way generally meant dirty in another, and after their conversation with Dina Donaldson, he'd come on board with Barbara Havers's conclusion that the PCSO was dirty, at least with regard to the college-age girls in Ludlow. The difficulty was that they had no substantial proof of this.
While it was true that Harry Rochester had more than once witnessed Ruddock loading binges into his patrol car, and while it was equally true that the Dosser claimed he had seen Francie Adamucci alone with him, that was the limit of what they had on the PCSO, which no prosecutor on earth was going to take to the bank and make a deposit with. They also had Barbara's sighting of Ruddock and Dina in the car park of the police station at night, but there again it was something that took them no great distance. What Barbara had seen, just like what Harry had seen, was not evidentiary. While the two girls might claim that the PCSO was forcing them into sex acts, Ruddock could claim with equal credibility that those were false accusations based on a girl's desire for vengeance as he did his job and cleared the streets. Going back through the various times when he'd had to do exactly that was going to support his claim while doing nothing at all to support what the girls might say about him. So while Thomas Linley and Barbara Havers had a clearer picture of Gary Ruddock and how he was using his position as Ludlow's PCSO, they had nothing irrefutable. He rang Ann Carter as his first action of the day once he was up, showered, shaved, dressed, and had a cup of hotel room morning tea in hand, hotel room morning coffee being something that he could not face. He sat on the bed, punched in the numbers of the DS's mobile, and said when he heard his voice, "What do we have? Because God knows we need something." "That kind of day already?" Carter inquired. "Merely girding myself," he replied. Carter started with West Mercia Police Headquarters, where Ruddock had received his training as a PCSO. He'd tracked down several of Ruddock's instructors, and their reports about him declared that "the bloke was earnest and dedicated," Carter told him. Apparently he'd been eager to work his way into the regular force, despite the ongoing cutbacks, and he saw this as a route that would take him there. "He was cleverer than most. Hang on," Linley said. "We've been told he's got some learning troubles. Is that not the case?" Carter replied with, "I mean clever in a different way, Inspector." It turned out that at the training centre Ruddock had learned to compensate for his difficulties by rubbing any elbow that belonged to a higher-up in the organisation. This got his name recognised and his mug known, Carter told Linley.
"From what I can tell, Gov, he was practically guaranteed a placement at the end of the day, as PCSO, I mean, because the cutbacks were coming fast when he was in training."
This was interesting, but it spoke of little save a young man who'd wisely learned how to compensate for his difficulties. "Anything else?" Linley asked.
"His background tells an interesting story."
"The cult in Donegal, I presume." Linley had made his tea in one of the ubiquitous hotel tin pots, and he poured himself a refill.
"Right," Carter said. "That's where it gets interesting. Did he mention to Bob the place got broke up by the Garda?"
"This was about 10 years ago." "What was going on?"
"Massive sex abuse. Cult leaders claimed it was God's dictate written in the Holy Book. Increase and multiply and fill the earth, and they were only following God's instructions, see? Only nobody had a choice in the matter, and that included boys as well as girls. If a boy looked like he was a grand candidate in the increasing and multiplying department, he got taken to this place called the Palace of God's Will, which, from what I've read, wasn't exactly palatial."
"I wouldn't wager against that," Linley said.
"There he'd be told to do the business on whichever female had been selected for him. Didn't matter ages, either. For boys, this generally started when they were around 12 years old. For girls, it was soon as they were old enough to have a kid without dying in the process. The lucky girls were the ones slow to develop. The others? The youngest gave birth when she was 11.
"Christ, I don't remember any of this, Winston. Was it in the papers at the time?"
"Probably. But as it was in the Republic and not the North, it wouldn't have been as big a story here. And anyway, where were you and what were you doing 10 years ago?" "I was trying to extricate myself from the warriors, so what was happening in other countries didn't matter that much to me."
"What happened to all the children involved?"
"Went into care if they were underage. How old would your boy have been?"
16, I think. He told Barbara he ran off when he was 15.
"Probably did. I come up with a blank on him for a bit of time. When he shows up out of the ether, he's in Belfast in the building trade. 18, then. He goes from there to England by way of Wales, where he did carpentry. But he's not ever got into trouble, Inspector. He might not have told Barb all the details about the cult, like the Palace of God's Will and all that, but from what you gave me, he checks out."
Which, Linley thought as he rang off, did not make the man not complicit in other ways. But with Winston's search, they got no further, and they'd certainly not got close to being able to back Ruddock into a corner with regard to the claims being made about his behaviour with young women. When the room phone rang, he picked it up absently, assuming Winston was ringing with something he'd forgotten. He said, "There's more," and was instantly jarred by Isabel Ardrey's sharp voice.
"Are you avoiding my calls, Tommy?" she demanded. "Why the hell haven't you rung me back?"
She sounded completely normal, which was something of a relief. She sounded completely normal, which was also something of a worry. He replied with, "Sorry, Gov, we've been on the run up here."
"When I ring you, Inspector, you're to ring me back. I remain your senior officer, and if you have just added 'for now' to what I said, I caution you not to do that."
"I haven't at all, Gov," he said.
"I'm very glad to hear that. Get out the suicide photos, please."
"At the moment, I don't actually have them. They're in Sergeant Haven—"
"Well, bloody well get them! When you have them in hand, which I will give you exactly 10 minutes to accomplish, ring me at once, and put yourself in a place where your side of our next conversation will not be overheard. Am I being clear?"
"Do you mean by Sergeant Havers as well?" he said.
"Don't be ridiculous. I'm not so stupid as to believe you wouldn't report every word we speak directly back to her anyway. Now get those photos and ring me back!"
Ironbridge, Shropshire. Rabia had forced her son to get up at dawn. She could have done with an extra 2 hours' lie-in, but that was one of the many things that were not going to be an option today. So was the idea of either of them, Yasmina or Timothy, going to work. They were going to remain at home if she had to tie both of them to kitchen chairs. This would not be a problem for Timothy, as doubtless he'd failed to show up at the pharmacy on any fixed schedule in months. Yasmina was another matter, and she would have to cancel patients. But she was going to do that. This was, Rabia reckoned, a last-ditch effort. She'd readied herself as if to do battle when she went to awaken her younger son. The information he'd brought her last night had been so gobsmacking that she'd not checked either his pockets or the carrier bag when he'd shown up on her doorstep. For all she knew, he'd drugged himself, which meant he would not be easy to awaken. No matter, as she took a jug of water with her as the only weapon she could devise. But he was sitting up in bed. True, his eyes were closed, but he wasn't sleeping, as he opened them the moment he heard the door's movement. He saw the jug and said, "I left without them. I was in a rush, or I would have brought them, believe me. I didn't sleep. Nor did I. Get up, we're going to Ironbridge."
"Mum, do you think I want to get into the middle of this? Do you actually think I believe I have even one answer regarding the massive mess you've made of your life?"
"If you don't have answers, what's the point?
The point is that you have the answers, you ninny. You and Yasmina have the answers, and you're taking a look at them today. She isn't going to want to do that. Do you also think that I care in the least what Yasmina wants? Get up, get dressed, and get in the car. You're driving to Ironbridge, and I'm following you there."
She gave him a quarter hour, since he requested a shower. While he was taking it, she gathered up the clothing he'd tossed on the floor, and she put it into the carrier bag. This she took to the front door. It would make the only statement necessary to explain how willing she was not to have Timothy run off from his troubles and ask to take up lodging with her. He didn't mention the bag when he was dressed. Lucky for him, she thought, that he'd carried clothing into the bathroom, or he'd be driving to Ironbridge in his pyjamas, which was also just absolutely fine with her. At that hour there was no traffic aside from one articulated lorry outside of Bridgenorth attempting to negotiate a way into the heart of the upper town. Before and after that, it was only a matter of not hitting some confused animal that might wander into the road, as they sped along chasing the growing daylight. Rabia went into the house alone when they reached Ironbridge, after informing Timothy that he was to wait just outside the front door. She heard sounds from the kitchen suggesting that Yasmina, too, was up and about. As her daughter-in-law was not in sight, Rabia then roughly motioned Timothy inside and murmured that he would remain in the entry until his presence was required. In the kitchen, Rabia found Yasmina with Sati's Hello Kitty lunchbox gaping. She was in the midst of cutting the crusts off a sandwich she'd apparently made for the girl. She appeared to be accompanying this with an apple, a snack packet of fig bars, and another packet of crisps, along with a carton of juice with straw attached. Yasmina swung round when Rabia said,
"You don't expect her to eat all that after yesterday, do you?"
Yasmina recovered quickly from the surprise of her mother-in-law's sudden appearance in her kitchen at 6 in the morning. She turned back to what she'd been doing and said,
"Timothy told you, I see. I'm taking this to Sati's school. I want to apologize to her. Aren't you getting ahead of yourself?"
Yasmina looked over her shoulder without reply.
Rabia went on with, "You're presupposing.
First, that she's even going to show up at school today with evidence on her face of having been punched by her mother. Second, that she will want to have a conversation with you if she is there.
Be that as it may, Yasmina said with curious dignity, all things considered. I must do this, Mum.
Rabia stepped forward. She reached round the other woman and snapped the lunchbox closed.
What you must do, if we've arrived at the point of musts, is this. You must sit the hell down, either here or elsewhere. The three of us are having a conversation.
You must know that Sati has left.
I'm not talking about Sati,
Rabia called out. Timothy, you're wanted. He came round from the entry. In doing so, Rabia was reminded of him as a boy, and saw how little things had actually changed. He had that hangdog expression about him, caught out for doing whatever he'd done that he knew he wasn't supposed to do, but had done anyway, and now hoping for some kind of reprieve if he managed to look pathetic enough. This had worked at one time, and Rabia was outraged at herself that she'd allowed it. When he joined them in the kitchen, she said, "I'm not here to sort out your marriage. You're going to do that if you want to do that. But I am here to tell you that you're not to leave this house until you next hear from me, because my concern is Misa and Sati, not the two of you. I'm leaving here now to speak to them. If I have any luck at all, I might be able to bring one of them, or, God willing, both of them home. And we three know bloody well at this point that's not about to happen if either of you tag along. Mum, Timothy said, let me come.
I've done nothing. For God's sake, do not try to tell me you've done nothing to cause this. I'm not here to look for causes of anything, and neither should you be. I'm here because at this moment we are still a family, and I intend us to remain a family. Anything else is unthinkable, and if you two are not on board with that, I suggest you get on board. A hell of a lot is going to have to go on in this house, besides apologizing. Apologies mean sod all if they aren't accompanied by change. Do either of you come anywhere close to understanding what I'm talking about? Don't bother to answer. Just give me the Goodale's goddamn address and remain in this house till you hear from me.
Neither of them argued. Yasmina produced the address and handed it over. Rabia left them. The Goodales' home did not prove difficult to find. They lived high enough above the town to be almost part of Woodside. To reach it, Rabia drove through the area where the magnates had lived during the Industrial Revolution, owners of the local factories that had fashioned everything from decorative iron doorstops to delicate china teapots. They'd occupied large Georgian homes of brick, which had fallen into disrepair during the last century and were slowly being restored to their classical beauties now. The Goodales did not live in one of these, but rather beyond them and higher still. It was yet another area that had fallen upon hard times, but again some of these homes were in the process of restoration. The home of the Goodales was not one of them. Their house, like so many others nearby, was constructed of Broseley brick. It featured a garden in the front, unlike the houses lower down on the hillside that nosed directly onto the street. When Rabia parked and clambered out of the car to head towards the front door, she saw that the garden had been set up as a battle site. Plaster gnomes, wearing handmade Highland kilts, had apparently been facing off against their British enemies. Also plaster gnomes, but these in their regulation gnome kit, although accentuated by smallish Union Jacks set up behind them, and both plastic muskets and rubber swords at their feet. Several of the soldiers had, alas, suffered at the hands of Highland warriors. Two were headless, and one was missing an arm. In spite of herself, Rabia smiled. The Goodales, as she recalled, had five children, and the eldest was at least a decade older than Justin. There had obviously been grandchildren at play here. Actively imaginative grandchildren, it seemed. When she gave the door a good pounding, it was Sati who opened it. She carried a bowl of cereal and a spoon, and she had a splash of milk on her chin. At the sight of Rabia, her eyes became the size of penny coins. She apparently didn't know what to say because her mouth opened, then closed, and she sucked in on her lip before looking over her shoulder into the body of the house. Rabia said, "Ask your gran inside first. Give her a hug second. That'll do for now." Sati stepped back, eyes still huge. There was no place to put the cereal bowl save on the floor, which she did so that she could obey the direct order. The fact that she would do this made Rabia's regret stir inside of her. The Lomax daughters had needed to fight to be individuals, and mostly they'd failed. Why had she not seen it before this moment? She hugged the little girl and kissed the top of her head. She tilted her face up and looked at the bruising. She said, "Your mum's very upset about this. She wants you to come home long enough for her to say sorry." Sati's great dark eyes grew bright, but she didn't let any tears escape.
"Missa says no need, Sati.
I'm not here to talk you into going home. It's Missa I've come to have a word with. When and if you go home, that's up to you. Understood?
Sati picked up her cereal bowl. Her answer was a whispered,
All right. Maths still giving you difficulty?
She nodded again.
We'll need to sort that. Meantime, fetch Missa for me. There's my lovely girl. Tell her I want a word, and it's not about either of you going home to your mum.
Kay, was her reply, along with a shy smile that made Rabia's heart give a twist. Then she was gone up the stairs, and Rabia found her way to the sitting room. It was, like the garden outside, kitted out for the grandkids' enjoyment. There were dozens of toys, but all of them were neatly stored in boxes with labels bearing each child's name. There was also a shelf of board games, and from a doorway leading into a dining room, a bouncy baby swing was hanging. There were pictures everywhere. Grandchildren, marriages, christenings, university graduations. There was also a display case designed for collectibles, into which a number of infant handprints and footprints had been rendered in clay, and several bronzed baby shoes were interspersed among them.
"Mrs. Lomax, is it?"
Rabia swung round. The woman who greeted her was late middle-aged and dressed neatly in a tartan skirt, tailored blouse and waistcoat. This would be Linda Goodale. She didn't bear an expression of welcome, but Rabia reckoned Justin's mum assumed that Mrs. Gran had shown up on her doorstep as an emissary of the family.
"It's Rabia," she said. "Sorry to barge in like this. I've come to speak with Missa. Her mum didn't send me, by the way. It's nothing to do with..."
She wasn't sure how to put it, so she gestured round the room and said,
"Anything, actually, aside from Ludlow." "She's not going back, if that's why you've come. She's tried to make that clear to her parents, but it's done no good."
"Completely understandable," Rabia said. "What I mean is that Missa's old enough to know her own mind. I might not agree with what her mind's telling her, but I'm fully on board with the idea of the girl having a mind in the first place." She heard, then, the clatter of footsteps on the stairs, and Justin appeared in the doorway. She was struck by the size of him, which was less noticeable when he was in his milieu at the Victorian blacksmith's shop. Like his mother, he was dressed for his workday, and his hair was tied back in traditional fashion. He said,
"If you're here to talk her out of it, it's no go, Mrs. Lomax."
Rabia drew a blank at that.
"Out of what?"
she asked him.
"Do you mean living here? Well, that's not why I've come."
"I mean the wedding," he said. "Me and Missa, next month."
Rabia was moderately horrified at the idea that Missa would marry anyone in just a month's time, considering the chaos in her family. She wondered if that had been what she'd been discussing with Druitt. She found the voice to say,
"Congratulations, then. I'd not yet been told when, just that it was intended."
"Mum doesn't want it," Missa said.
She'd come in perfect silence down the stairs, and she stood behind Justin. Unlike the young man and his mother, she'd apparently been roused from bed by her sister, since she was in a dressing gown and slippers, and her hair was still tousled from sleep.
"So if you've come to have a go at that, you can turn round and leave, Gran."
Rabia waved her off, a poo-poo motion that she hoped would disarm not only the girl, but also Justin and his mother.
"Give us a hug, for God's sake," she said. "You can marry who you want, when you want, as far as I'm concerned. I'll be cross if I'm not invited, though."
Missa didn't look convinced, but she did come into the sitting room, and she did allow herself to be hugged, and she did hug Rabia in return. That was step one in Rabia's mind. Step two was being rid of Justin and his mother so that she and Missa could speak privately. She cared not one whit about being presumptuous. She said,
"Might I have a cup of coffee, Justin?"
He and his mother exchanged a look. Something meaningful passed between them. Linda Goodale said, with an attempt at sounding welcoming at this hour of the morning,
"Of course. I'll see to it. Do make yourself comfortable."
That handled Linda, but Justin looked immobile, so Rabia went at him directly, saying,
"Justin, I need to speak with Missa alone. I'm not here to discuss the two of you, however, so you've no need to worry about that."
Missa looked towards the young man, and he waited for her decision. She said after a moment,
"Gran's not going to talk me out of anything, Justy. She's also not going to talk me into anything. It's fine. No worries. Tell Sati for me, okay?"
He left them, but Rabia could tell he was reluctant to do so. She waited till she heard his footsteps on the stairs before she quickly said to Missa,
"This isn't about Sati. This isn't about your mother or your father, who they are, what they've done, the whole bit of it. This is about me, and this is about you."
Missa appeared confused by this, as well she might. Rabia and the girl had always been close, so that there was a me and you that needed talking about would be a perplexing issue. Rabia went on,
I've had the London police at my home 3 times now, Missa, and 3 times I've lied to them. As far as I can tell, there isn't a person in this family who doesn't lie, save Sati, perhaps, and she might be too young to have mastered the art, but that's about to stop. No, don't speak a word. I've been willing to believe that your 7 encounters with Ian Druitt were about gathering some kind of support for leaving West Mercia College. I understand that you would need someone's support to do this, as you certainly weren't getting it from anyone else. But what I do not understand is why you apparently believe that your own grandmother would be unwilling to support your wishes. Moreover, what I do not understand is why you suddenly took the decision to leave at all. Please don't respond, dear. I see